Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3145, United States of America versus Reginald Baum, appellant. Mr. Perkins for appellant, Mr. Bounds for appellee.
Mr. Perkins, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Marshall Perkins, Mallon and McCool for appellant Reginald Baum. And initially, I want to apologize. An attorney that has since left our firm oversaw the final filing of the brief and apparently the provision of the 1967 D.C. Code that we had referred to was not included, but I understand Your Honors now have that. Mr. Baum was convicted of conspiracy and two other drug-related offenses. The convictions were affirmed by prior opinion of this court. Mr. Baum raises three issues in this appeal, challenging his sentence. The primary issue presented is a failure to comply with the enhancement provision, 21 U.S.C. 851A. Conviction of the substantive offense under 21 U.S.C. 841 authorized an enhanced sentence if and only if 851A was complied with. In turn,
how do you interpret, or how do you read Van Ness versus Kennedy as far as the standard of review? I mean, Van Ness says it's not jurisdictional, strict compliance, but it says a gratuitous misstatement was harmless error there. Then Kennedy says harmless error is not applicable here.
Your Honor, I would, well, to back up slightly, early on in the process, I think with 851A especially, some courts in the Seventh Circuit comes to mind had ruled that a failure to comply with 851A was jurisdictional, meaning that if it wasn't done, the court didn't have jurisdiction to even enter an enhanced sentence. The Seventh Circuit, I believe, has since reversed on that, and that, I think, led to the comments that you've seen in this court that, and one sticks with me, and I forget the case, and I apologize, but, you know, the court said jurisdiction is a word of too many, far too many meanings. And put it more simply, which is that it's a condition precedent, meaning that if the government doesn't comply, that's fine, but the government can't seek enhancement and the court can't do it sua sponte. It's a point made by then Judge Breyer, now Justice Breyer, in the First Circuit case we've cited, and also in a United States Supreme Court footnote that we cited, I believe it was the Labonte case, that it's not like a constitutional provision, which is kind of self-executing and a defendant has that right, which can be waived. That's something separate. This is a statutory scheme that has to be complied with. The government can seek enhancement, but does not have to do so. And whether intentionally or through inadvertence, if the government fails to file the 851A notice, it's a condition precedent to seeking enhancement, and the failure to file a proper notice means there is no enhancement. So that's why
they filed it here. They filed a notice. The caption was correct. The body was not correct with respect to the defendant. How is that different from Van Ness, where they filed the notice, but this gratuitous misstatement about you are facing a 10-year minimum when in fact he was facing a life minimum, and the court said, even though we don't like the word jurisdictional, even though we say there has to be strict compliance, this was a gratuitous misstatement, and although Van Ness didn't mention the clerical error language of 851A, wouldn't this fit into that?
I think there are two points on that, Your Honor. First of all, in the Van Ness case, that wasn't required information. In other words, the, you know, what's required is whatever the statute says, but things like you have to identify the defendant, you have to state the prior offenses, the term of the offenses, if you will, or the potentiality of sentencing is not required by the statute. Therefore, the government could have...
That's not true, because what you're giving him notices or notice of is his of his enhanced punishment, or that they're seeking that. And so the first part of it is you've got this criminal record and you've got these prior convictions, and because of that, here is the enhancement. We're seeking enhancement. And in the case of Van Ness, it was a 10-year minimum when it was really a life minimum.
That is what this court said, which is that information didn't need to be in the information. I'm using the same word twice, but didn't need to be in the information required by 851. That's why it held what it did, and that's why it could say harmless error analysis is inappropriate. This is a condition precedent. The other thing to back up on your Honor's premise leading into the question is Mr. Baum's position is that information was not filed. This is a case where valid information, at least an efficacious information, was not filed, and therefore this is different from Van Ness in that way also.
It was filed. It was this fellow's name was on the caption. His convictions were listed. You'd have a closer case if, in addition to naming the wrong defendant in the body of it, they put that defendant's criminal record in.
That's true, but that's a different case, as Your Honor recognizes. Two things about that. The first I would say is I don't think the name in the caption has any significance. Criminal Rule 49D provides for, in a criminal case, the filing of a paper as in a civil action. Civil Rules 10A and 7B2 indicate that in a multi-party case, the name of the first party goes in the caption. Thus, in a multi-defendant case, no meaningful inference may be drawn by the party identified in the caption. In addition, if this were a case where there was only Mr. Baum's name in the caption and that was it, it might be a different issue. I'm not conceding that. But clearly where you have a caption that says Reginald Baum and you have in the body the statement of Mr. Morris, the co-defendant, it's at least ambiguous. And I think the government has not complied on that point. And we cite the Ohio case in the briefing, which indicates that basically the caption is ineffective and what's in the body of the document is what's controlling. Even if the court wouldn't decide that, even if the court would decide being named in the caption is a factor, I still think the body of the document is at least as probative and as controlling as any caption, and therefore there's a fatal inherent ambiguity.
Let me ask you this. Does the caption recite the other co-defendants?
It does not, Your Honor. It says only Mr. Baum.
Right, so what relevance does it have that this is a multi-defendant? I mean, the rule you read about the name not making any difference in a multi-party caption.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a plea, or this is a document that is directed to this one defendant.
That's
correctly directed to him. I mean, his name is on the caption.
That's correct, Your Honor. The point being that I don't think there's the legal significance to his name being in the caption. In other words, any of the defendant's name could be in the caption, but most properly Defendant Honesty, who was the first listed. But again, I think the body, if it does not control, at least is as or more probative than the caption, and therefore there's fatal ambiguity in the document.
So it's the correct case number?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you know whether at the first sentencing the 851 issues were addressed in any way?
I do not believe they were, Your Honor, because Mr. Baum at the first sentencing was subject to sentencing under the guidelines, and the focus was on that. Okay, and I have a short time left, and I'll reserve that for rebuttal. All Thank right. you.
Mr. Baum.
Good morning, Ryan Bounce, United States. May it please the court, I'm joined by Suzanne Kurt, who is a supervising attorney in the appellate session of the U.S. Attorney's Office and also was the representative of the United States in the first appeal from this trial. As Judge Henderson has correctly noted, one of the principal issues in this case is the interplay of Van Ness and Kennedy, which was an opinion that Judge Henderson joined and was authored by Judge Rogers, in the review of the alleged errors under 851 in this case. The threshold issue is the standard of review, and here none of the claims that the appellant raises were raised at either of the sentencings that the appellant
objected to any enhancement.
He did object to enhancements as a categorical matter. However, he did so even while acknowledging the existence of those convictions, and never explaining that the basis for his objection was any violation of 851. So this is a plain error case, unlike Kennedy and even unlike Van Ness, although Judge Henderson is correct in acknowledging the similarity of Van Ness to this case, where the alleged error in the government's information relates to information or a datum in the government's information that was not even required by 851A. So all the requirements of 851A, which are the government file an information before trial, listing the appellant's defendant's prior convictions on which the government will rely, those three elements were satisfied by the government's information. And so appellant is only complaining about a gratuitous misstatement of the sort that Van Ness recognized was irrelevant to the effectiveness of the notice. The last point on 851A.
Excuse me, I just... I think that Van Ness was saying something different, which is that the point of this, what's required under 851, is notice to the defendant about the prior actions on which the enhancement's going to be based, right? And so Van Ness was saying it's not about the consequences of that. So if the sentencing is wrong, maybe that's not a problem. But it seems to me that the notice part of it is what 851 is all about. And if you don't have the correct name on there telling him that these are your prior convictions, why doesn't that matter?
You're perfectly correct, Judge Brown, that notice to the defendant that he is the one facing jeopardy under the information is the critical inquiry. And as I was about to say, the other point that the government wants to make in, with respect to the 851A claim is that there was absolutely no fatal ambiguity, as the appellant would have the court believe, in this case. There was never any question raised by any party at any time that this information applied to the defendant below. And in addition to the fact that the caption correctly identified this defendant and this defendant only, notwithstanding the rule that the first listed party would, in a civil proceeding, be the primarily listed party on the caption, the appellant in this case was not the first listed party in the indictment. He was the only listed party in the information. And not only was his name listed to the exclusion of all others, but they were his convictions, the existence of which were never questioned by appellant and were repeatedly acknowledged by appellant's counsel below. And in addition to that, only the defendant's counsel was served with this information. There's absolutely no basis for claiming that there was any ambiguity at all, much less a fatal ambiguity. So I do believe that 851A, the 851A claim should be evaluated under Van Ness as opposed to Kennedy. And of course, is a plain error review case, unlike...
So it's a clerical error?
Certainly, Your Honor. To look at it is to notice that this is basically a cut-and-paste creation of a document that was filed against a number of parties in this case. And so I believe it's fairly clear.
I would say et al.
Quite right. But I think happened, what's fairly clear that happened is the prosecutor created a number of 851A informations against a number of the defendants in this case below, and properly subbed out the party's name in the caption, subbed out the convictions in the list of convictions, but forgot that there was a separate and completely gratuitous reference to the defendant by name in the body of the information.
I forgot to put the name of the defendant in the case name.
Well, there's certainly no requirement that the name of the defendant be indicated in otherwise clear, unambiguous, and not erroneous identification of the prior conviction. Here we have the correct case, correct charge, correct date, and they were all cases that the appellant repeatedly recognized were his convictions.
And where do we find that?
On page...
as opposed to his attorney.
Well, it was through his attorney, but in certainly...
That's my point.
But unlike...
How did the judge address the defendant about his prior conviction?
At his resentencing, well, at both sentencings, the appellant allocuted before sentencing. And at the latter sentencing, the appellant specifically spoke after his counsel in open court, referred to his prior convictions, and referred to his own belief that the court was bound by those prior convictions to impose the 20-year mandatory minimum. And so, but he acknowledged that he had a disagreement of law.
I thought all he said was he wasn't making excuses.
The appellant's counsel?
His attorney said a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the defendant and the judge having a colloquy.
Why, quite right, Your Honor. What happened was the appellant's counsel below spoke first, as is the normal course, and addressed what he understood to be the legal requirement that the 20-year mandatory minimum would apply in this case. But he also acknowledged that he had a disagreement with his client, the defendant and appellant here, about whether that 20-year mandatory minimum would be binding on the court in this case. And he had repeatedly asked the court if there was any way possible, although he could not find any, for the court to deviate from the 20-year mandatory minimum. But he said that he then referred specifically to the fact that his client was going to address the court about this issue. And when the client addressed the court, the client did not in any way dispute the existence and validity of those prior convictions, or even ask the court to avoid the enhancement. The appellant simply referred to his desire to help wayward youths and for the court's mercy with respect to the sentence.
What is your best case for clerical error?
Well,
I mean, what case? What case recognizes something as a clerical error, and what was it?
The Ninth Circuit, in a case that we cite in our brief, and I apologize to the court, the name of it is escaping me. I believe it's Henderson, but I believe it starts with an H in any event. The Ninth Circuit referred to a clerical error where the conviction as listed was wrongly enumerated in the information and held that that was a clerical error that could be amended under the provisions of A51A itself.
The statutory site? What was the error?
I'm sorry?
The statutory site?
The conviction. The conviction as listed in the information was wrongly identified. I believe the Seventh Circuit has also addressed a case where the conviction was wrongly characterized. I mean, that sort of clerical error has been the subject of a number of these sorts of claims. None where the...
I think it's a Seventh Circuit case. It reversed. I didn't know a Seventh Circuit case said it was harmless.
Well,
or not plain error.
One of the cases that we cite in a footnote of our brief from the Seventh Circuit describes the situation where one of the convictions that the government is relying upon was either omitted from or mischaracterized by the information. I think it may have been omitted from the information, and a subsequent filing by the government before trial fully identified those prior convictions. And the court in the Seventh Circuit held that that was sufficient notice under 851A.
So your other argument is, as I understand it, it doesn't really matter.
Quite right.
Because of subsection E.
Well, this is a plain error review case. And so, because none of these issues were raised below. And so, as a result...
Well, what I'm trying to get you to focus on is the obligation is on the district court. All right.
Correct.
The cases in this circuit, other circuits, have said that there's where the obligation lies.
With respect to 851B, that's correct, Your Honor. The colloquy.
That's what I've been talking about.
I'm sorry.
Whether the defendant ever got to talk about this conviction that's mm-hmm. in the information. And I thought your argument in part was that even if he had wanted to contest it, there's nothing that could have happened because of the statute of limitations provision in subsection E.
Indeed.
But I thought the cases were trying to focus on he might have something else to say. In other words, I was convicted, but I really wasn't an important player
That was a consideration that was relevant to this court's en banc decisions in Marshall and Clemens, which were reviewing convictions and sentences under a related or similar statute in the D.C. Municipal Code. And in those cases, this court held that because of the defendant's interest in allocuting as to his minimal role or culpability with those prior convictions for purposes of avoiding a discretionary enhancement, i.e. an increased maximum penalty, the defendant had to be given a specific opportunity to address his role in those crimes if he wanted to do so. Here, the harmlessness is much more patent because the defendant could have done nothing about it even if he had engaged in this colloquy and it was
but
a mandatory minimum.
Hypothetical.
I'm sorry?
I just gave you the hypothetical.
A hypothetical where he could do something about it?
That I wasn't, you know, a very important player.
It would have nothing to do with this case as opposed to those earlier cases under the D.C. Code because this case is a mandatory minimum case. So the judge imposed a fine that reflected in large part the fact that the defendant was going to be in jail for 20 years less than he was expected to be under the original sentence, as well as the fact that the defendant had expressed at his
The judge said he just wanted to be sure he worked.
Right, and as I was going to say, the judge, it also reflected the defendant's own allocution, which shifted in the first sentencing, where he said he wanted to go to work as an underwater welder to...
I just want to be clear from the government's point of view, what's left of this statute? The government files a piece of paper that cites a number of a case where the defendant was one of the co-defendants. There's no colloquy under B.
Mm-hmm. Well...
And because it's a mandatory minimum, that's the end of the discussion, and the statute really has no role to play.
Well, that is not actually the government's position. The government's position is where, the issue was not raised at all below. It was not objected to even after sentence was imposed. And it's a plain error review case. The utter lack of prejudice because under 851E, the defendant could have done nothing to attack those prior convictions. And in addition to the fact, the defendant never betrayed any lack of acknowledgement, or unawareness.
How about answering my question?
Well, the government's position in this case is that because he didn't raise it below, what remains of the statute is everything.
The role of the statute.
The role of the statute is to require the government to file under 851A an information.
So if it files
mm-hmm.
with a proper case number,
mm-hmm. and
it doesn't matter. That B is not complied with because we're talking about a mandatory minimum and the statute of limitations has expired.
Under Gaviria, well, let me say this. Under Gaviria, it is true that unlike Kennedy, which recognized no harmlessness in an 851A error case, but an 851B, which is the sort of error you're speaking of, harmlessness analysis does apply. And so to the extent that the defendant could not have attacked the validity of those prior convictions, irrespective of the colloquy that he had with the court, it is true that...
The answer to my question is yes?
No, 851A still exists under the statute.
With respect to... He files a piece of paper that mm-hmm. has the right case number on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mandatory minimum.
Mm-hmm.
The statute of limitations... means that there's no way the judge can ignore the conviction.
I would argue that under the statute, if the defendant pleaded ignorance of the existence of those convictions or wanted to attack their pertinence to him, if the defendant wanted to say there was a different Reginald Baum, he could say that. What he could not say is these prior convictions were constitutionally infirm because that's what's precluded under 851E, an attack on the validity of those convictions. And certainly, if he were claiming that there was some prejudice, i.e. he actually lacked notice, as opposed to the defendant's claim here on appeal, that even though there was absolutely no evidence of a lack of notice, we're going to pretend that there was because of an alleged fatal ambiguity in the information, which, of course, did not exist here.
There's no obligation on the district court to engage in the inquiry under B.
Well, there are district courts always have an obligation to faithfully discharge the law, and the law requires them to have this colloquy. There's no dispute that there was an error under 851B here. The question is what the remedy is. And there is no remedy called for because to remand for resentencing would be an empty exercise resulting in exactly the same sentence.
You going to talk about the fine at all?
Well, as with the other claims raised on appeal, this is a plain error case because as the case that the defendant relies upon for this issue, Texas versus McCulloch, makes clear it is appropriate for the defendant to raise his concern with vindictiveness before the district court, as the appellant did in that case. And the defendant never did that here. And so there was no objection. It's plain error, and there's absolutely no basis for either inferring or finding vindictiveness. And it strains credulity to argue that a 20-year lighter sentence plus $1,000 is not a lighter sentence than he had originally. So if there are no further questions.
I thought it was interesting that the defendant argued that he was sentenced to the minimum the first time and the second time, but now he's got the fine as well.
It's an interesting argument, to be sure. If the court would like to entertain the appellant's position on whether he would prefer to have his original sentence, I think it would be illuminating to find out what the appellant's position would be on that.
That's a cute answer, but it really doesn't get to the point, does it?
Well, the whole point under Pierce is whether this was a vindictive sentence, i.e. whether he got a heavier sentence than he had before.
I was going to argue that there was no evidence that the district court was vindictive. The district court gave an explanation as to why he imposed the fine that had nothing to do with vindictiveness.
Certainly true, but
That's the end of the argument, isn't it? Whether it's plain error or not.
There are at least two reasons that argument can't avail, and one of them is the one Your Honor identified. The other one is that there was certainly not a heavier sentence in this case. If the court has no...
I actually want to go back to the argument under 851B. Does the result that the government is arguing for there depend on this being a plain error standard?
No. Thank you, Your Honor. It's a good question. Under Gaviria, this court has already squarely held that even though this statute requires strict adherence, there can be harmlessness. And here, it's a harmless error. So it doesn't need to be a plain error case. It's simply there's just no harm of any sort. So there wouldn't be any relief on this claim.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How much time does Mr. Perkins have? Why don't you take a minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. On the clerical mistake or clerical error issue, there are some cases I'd like to bring to the court's attention not cited in the briefing relating to Rule 36. There's Bird, B-U-R-D, 86 F-3rd, 285, which is a Second Circuit case discussing what is and what is not clerical mistake, and including the statement that misidentification is not clerical mistake under Rule 36. It used the word clerical mistake under 36 as opposed...
I thought the argument was the only thing that wasn't in the statement was et al.
Our argument is that the 851A argument is that the failure to unambiguously identify the criminal defendant means that the notice was not effective.
But that's not what the statute requires.
Well, we have cited, especially at pages 10 and 11 of the reply brief. Let's back up. 851A requires an information.
It's an information stating in writing the previous convictions to be relied upon.
And an information, and this is the Garcia case says this, and I believe there's one other case that says this, an information is to be interpreted as an information under Rule 7, similar to an indictment. And we cite the cases at 10 and 11 of the reply brief whereby one element required of an information is to unambiguously identify the defendant. And that's a requirement, and it was not complied with here.
And where was that unambiguous identification in that case not appearing in whatever case you're citing?
Well, there are various ones, including the wrong person being named.
Named where? In the caption, in the body, where?
I think these are cases from 100 years ago. I would not be clear on that, Your Honor. Thank you. Also, Corey, K-H-O.
Can I just be clear?
Yeah, certainly.
Do you have this argument if it had said the proper case number, the lead defendant's name, comma, et al.?
Yes, our position, Mr. Baum's position, is that
by... You had to say your Baum's name.
Well, it had to say Mr. Baum's name, and it had to not say. What makes this ambiguous is saying Mr. Morris's name in the body. There, at that point, is fatal ambiguity, and I don't have to deal with a case where it might say Mr. Baum's and Mr. Morris's name in the body, or we can think of hundreds of hypotheticals. But here, where it says Mr. Morris's name in the body, only Mr. Morris's name, and it's not Mr. Baum's name in the title, it's at least fatally ambiguous. And again, the 11th Circuit Corey case, which is K-H-O-U-R-Y, 901 F. 2nd, 975, the 11th Circuit makes the point that inherent ambiguity is not clerical mistake. Al Ariane, which is the Middle District of Florida, 308 F. Sup. 2nd, 1322, at footnote 70, makes the point that misidentification is not clerical mistake. And the last point I touch on, if I can, is the United States point that what Mr. Baum's counsel said somehow speaks to Mr. Baum. Well, this court has already rejected that repeatedly. The conduct of counsel does not substitute for the requirements under the statute. Also, I would point out, I think there's a difference in going back and looking at this versus what was said in 2003 and the papers that were filed versus what was said by Mr. Martin, Mr. Baum's counsel, in 2007. And I think there was a lot of confusion at the second sentencing. There was discussions of prior acts, what occurred previously. I think there was a lot of confusion between the enhancement statute on Mr. Martin's part and what was there for the guidelines at the second sentencing. And I think if the attorney was confused, I think it's fair that Mr. Baum was confused, and I can tell you, but I can't tell you what he said. I can tell you, I think Mr. Baum was confused, and I think if you look at the transcript, if you look at what was filed in 2003, what was said in 2003, what was filed in 2007, what Mr. Martin said in 2007, I think Mr. Martin was confused. So if Mr. Martin's confused, I don't think you can attribute too much to Mr. Baum. And the last point I would make is that
your time's up.